Oh, Joe, mate, I'm hot off the cinema. I'm piping hot. I'm like a fresh warm bun straight out of the oven. I'm fully risen and the baker's taken me out.
And yet butter still wouldn't melt, would it?
It wouldn't. Although, I should caveat it. I'm not quite... I was piping hot, but then I was in central London.
Right.
And I had to leave central London on, what is it? It's like a Monday night. It's the Monday, the 30th, heaving with.
And it's the 29th.
The 29th. It's heaving.
It's between Christmas and New Year. That's what you're saying.
That's what I'm saying. It's heaving. I keep saying, that's the third time I've said heaving. Heaving with no shade, as they say, but tourists. A lot of people, a lot of tourists.
Is it really?
Yeah. I mean, well, they're just slow. People getting in my way, and I just want to get out. I don't want to hold on to this feeling, this piping hot cinema feeling.
You're like Marty Supreme. You just want to rush through the crowd, but they're all in your way, and you've got to run around them, and you're like, where's the Japanese guy? Let me play ping pong against him. But it's just, in reality, it's just a train back to South London.
No, I was like, yeah, I'm totally keyed into Mighty Supreme. But then also, added to that, I've left my family.
Oh, you've left them?
Yeah, I left my family today.
Oh, my God.
Yeah.
Is everything okay?
Yeah, no, it's fine. They're back at my in-laws, her parents. But I had to leave them to come into London because I've got a funeral tomorrow. And I have to...
Oh, you haven't left them for good?
No, absolutely not, no. Where did you get that idea from? Anyway, I had to come back for a funeral. It's very sad. A sad way to end the year.
Oh, dear.
But it meant I could sneak in some Marty Supreme.
All hail the dead.
All hail the dead.
Well, I mean, it just means, you know, what a great parting gift that your dead relative allowed you to be able to sneak in the second best film of the year between Christmas and New Year's. I mean, it's what your dead relative presumably would have wanted.
I think, yeah, it's hard to know. I think funerals are for the living. Mm. Okay, so because the dead are dead.
And, they're dead.
They're dead. And so funerals are for people to say goodbye and grieve and say goodbye and grieve and say goodbye. And so for the family as well, it's like who turns up and how do they turn up? And what everyone else, is the dead person, their loved one, are they thought of? Have they been thought of? They don't know that I went to the cinema the day before the funeral. And also, what is that of any interest to anyone?
Well, they might know, because when you walk in to that church tomorrow with a little spark in your step, they'll be like, this guy looks like he's just been to see Marty Supreme. You know, I went to a funeral the other day.
Oh, yeah.
And have to say, excellent funeral. One of the best because in relative terms of distance from me to the departed, close enough to feel something, far enough for that something not to be horrible, you know, that sweet spot, and also beautifully catered, eulogy, just terrific, really fantastic. You know, it was almost like going to the cinema to watch a film about an old woman's life.
Adam is the host now. The dynamic works better when Adam is the host. Adam prefers to be the host. And Joe prefers to be the participant. It's better overall when Adam is the host, and Joe is the participant. Let it never be spoken of again. The ghost. 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 The ghost.
Hi, it's me, Joe Devine, from the Movies You Forgot podcast, here with a quick editor's note. A couple of things before we get into this episode in earnest. The first thing, if it wasn't obvious already, there are some pretty significant spoilers in this episode. We actually try our best not to spoil plot, but I don't think you can really listen to this episode without having the film somewhat spoiled. So if you haven't seen it, and you would like to see it, then probably wait to listen to this until afterwards. The second thing I will say is, throughout this episode, you will hear me refer to Marty Supreme, here's a spoiler, as the second best film of the year. Now, that was largely in reference to a conversation comparing it to One Battle After Another, but actually what I'd like to say now is that this conversation happened before I subsequently saw the film Sentimental Value, which in mine and Adam's opinion is by far the best film of the year. So that does knock Marty Supreme, sorry Marty, down to third. As a small little piece... But such is the strength of my affection for the film's Sentimental Value that I felt I had to insert myself at this point and just let you know that that's what I think. That's all. I hope you enjoy the rest of the episode. Bye.
Hello and welcome to the Movies You Forgot podcast with me, the host, Adam Richmondo, and joining me as ever, it's Mr. Joe Devine.
Oh, hello.
This is the show where we chat about the movies you forgot you'd even seen in the first place, but this is a special. It's a cinema special. It's a me and Joe saw Marty Supreme at the cinema. A day apart? 2 days apart?
A day apart. Yeah, not together. You could be confused what you said for us seeing it together. No, that's reserved for only the most special of occasions. You know, it's not Gladiator 2, is it? It's Marty Supreme.
It is. And here's the letterboxed. Marty Supreme, directed by Josh Safdie. Here is the letterboxed. Dream big. In 1950s New York, Marty Mauser, a young man with a dream no one respects, goes to hell and back in the pursuit of greatness. Yes, please, letterboxed. You know, either, because it's a modern movie, people who write the blurbs have got better at writing blurbs, or Letterboxd is pulling better blurbs. It's 150 mins. I didn't like the look of that runtime. I very much enjoyed that runtime when I was in the cinema.
Oh, really?
It flew by, absolutely. And it stars Timothée Chalamet, Gwyneth Paltrow. He's Marty Mauser, his old Timothée. And that's about all you need to know about who's in it. It's a Timmy C show. It's the Timmy C show. It's A24.
Yeah.
It's the movie that everyone's chatting about.
It's a Timmy C vehicle, really.
Yeah, he produced it as well.
Sure.
Josh Safdie directs, usually he directs with his brother Benny, but they parted ways this year. Benny did The Smashing Machine with Dwayne The Rock Johnson, and Josh went off and did this with Timmy C.
No prizes for guessing which one has been better received and is probably a better film.
Well, we haven't seen The Smashing Machine.
No, that's why I said no prizes.
But yeah, The Smashing Machine was not smashingly received.
No.
But who knows? That could be a Forgot You Forgot in the future.
What happened to them? Why'd they break up?
They didn't break up. They just went, I think, Benny...
I read earlier that they are no longer working together.
I think because they've got their own projects and they now can go off and they don't have to sell each other as a pairing. I think Benny went off and did a TV show with Nathan of Nathan for You with Emma Stone called The Curse. He was in that. And then also Benny's acted and he was in Licorice Pizza.
Right, yes.
I mean, clearly Josh doesn't need Benny anymore on the basis of Marty Supreme. Marty Supreme is the apex of a Safdie movie. I didn't really enjoy Uncut Gems because I found it quite oppressive and overwhelming, and I didn't enjoy being with Adam Sandler.
Bit stressful.
But, yeah, and also just I was never involved in it, whereas this was both stressful but in a more engaging and entertaining fun way. I enjoyed being with Timothée Chalamet. Do you want to hear my take on Timothée Chalamet?
Yeah, sure.
This is his Leo performance. This is the Leo level performance that Leo gave back in the day that announced Leo as a serious actor.
Oh.
Okay, this is the Leo performance that Leo gave back in his late 20s or early 30s.
In what?
Specifically, it doesn't matter, but let's have a look. If you want me to pick the film, I'll pick the film. It's that intensity of the performance. Maybe I'm thinking Shutter Island, because Timmy C, he's done good stuff and he's been good in stuff. He's good in Dune. He's good in Dune 2. He's popped up in, he's good in Lady Bird.
Yeah.
But he's never quite, for me, this is like the level up, right? Let's go back.
I wonder if it was The Wolf of Wall Street. I think that's the film where he really announces himself as like that's where his what would you call it, his sort of late second act really starts, because everything up to then after Shutter Island. Inception's very safe. You know, I guess Django Unchained, he's more of a supporting cast member. He does something which is a little bit more out of the ordinary for Leo in that movie. But I do think that Wolf of Wall Street really kind of presented him as someone who was going to try new things.
Yeah, in terms of the mix of the comedy and the...
I think it's the first, like, air quotes, asterisk, different movie that he made. All of the ones prior to that, that he said that he had a lead role in. You think, for example, that Catch Me If You Can 2002, that's just such canon younger Leo. You know, young adult Leo, this is what he does. He tried a few things, nothing too risky outside of that. Inception is the first... You know, Inception is the kind of ending, let's say, or maybe The Great Gatsby is the end of what he started with Catch Me If You Can. But Wolf of Wall Street is, that's something altogether different. That's like him saying, cool, I've done that now, I need to do something new. And from that point on, we actually talked about this on a Leo episode not that long ago. After then, The Revenant, Once Upon a Time in Hollywood, Killers of a Flower Moon, One Battle After Another, he's like, the Wolf of Wall Street is his... different film.
I don't think you can fully say that. You're absolutely right, but you're also slightly wrong, because I think Django is very, very different. And then
that's true, but he's in a supporting role there, so it doesn't fully count.
Yeah, you could kind of blag that as a, but yeah, no, that is the film. I think that's the film I'm reaching for. Thank you so much for playing the game, Joe. You've won.
You're welcome.
A lovely prize.
What's the prize?
Oh, just to carry on talking to me.
Oh.
I feel like this is, it's still, what do you think about my theory? I'm not just baiting you. I felt like this is like a level up for Timmy C. And this announces him as the same, like he is the heir to the Leo throne now.
I think that's probably fair. Because when I look through Timothy Chalamet's discography, I feel what you've described, right? And that's why I feel that Wolf of Wall Street is the right analogy for this. Because if you look at the sort of films that Timothy Chalamet made when he, you know, so he's arrived on the scene, he's done his TV, he's, you know, he's got his face about there. Hollywood's like, oh, there's a young, attractive kid here at who's picking interesting projects. Also, you think about him in Lady Bird, for example, all the way back in 2017. He's terrific in that. He made a big splash, or he tried to, in Beautiful Boy with Steve Carell, which is still a film that is, you know, scenes of which are kind of everywhere on TikTok constantly since then.
Beautiful Boy, it was one of those awards, it was flirting with awards, but then it didn't bite, it didn't catch on people, but no one, it wasn't, he didn't disgrace himself in it, and I've never seen it because it looks too depressing.
Neither have I. It looks boring.
Oh, great.
And
review.
Also,
hey, should we spoil? Let's talk about Beautiful
No, but
Boy.
I know that he plays an addict in it, and I know that, yeah. You know, I know that he's playing something somewhere between, you know, transgressive and emotion and with an emotional core, right? Like that's what Timothy Chalamet has done in his younger career, and he's led that into Dune, which for the first stage of his career is his, that is everything that came before perfectly encapsulates. It's Timmy with some muscles.
I reckon because we can find analogous films as well between earlier on with Timmy C. Like, so Beautiful Boy is his Basketball Diaries, where, you know what I mean? I think, you know, we don't just have to be so broad. We can go in specific.
You want to do some more? You want to do more than that?
I think I do.
Yeah.
June,
because he's in Don't Look Up is Leo's Don't Look Up, right?
Is he in Don't Look Up?
Apparently so. Apparently he plays a character called Yule. I do not recall him in that film, but apparently he's in it. Yeah. Anyway, I think you know, Dune summarizes everything that came before. Then he tried Wonka, at which point we're going, okay, cool. He's definitely the guy. Then he's the guy because they've made him Wonka. He's not. He's not just the guy. He's the guy because they've made him Wonka.
But wait a sec. Let's talk about Wonka.
I didn't watch Wonka.
Right, because I did, but. That's different. You could argue that Wonka is the Wolf of Wall Street because that's quite an exposed, different. I'm going to be a song and dance man. I'm going to dare to try and do a Gene Wilder. I'm going to be in a kids movie. I've been in all this like high minded arty fare. It's Leonardo DiCaprio has never dared to be Wonka.
That's true. Leo's never really done a kids movie, has he? Apart from The Beach.
Oh, God damn it. Hang on a sec. Okay, you team me up now.
You want me to say that again? Yeah.
Yeah, yeah.
Okay, I mean, Leonardo DiCaprio's never really done a kids movie, has he?
Yeah,
apart from the beach.
Wait, you gotta let me have a go.
Leonardo DiCaprio's never really done a kids' movie, has he?
Yeah, unless you count.
Anyway, my point about Timothée Chalamet is that he goes from Wonka, which is not just, you know, not just a hugely famous, eccentric fictional character from the past. Also, one played by Gene Wilder, for example. It was played by Gene Wilder, wasn't it?
That's and Johnny Depp.
Yeah. And Johnny Depp, of course, eccentric people from the past. He also, the next year, decided, I'm going to be Bob Dylan as well. Those are two things in a row where someone around you, if you were making that choice, might go, have you, just one moment, hang on a second, have you considered that this might be a bad idea? And Timothée Chalamet is like, no, fuck that, I'm Wonka and Bob Dylan. And it seems to have been absolutely fine. I don't think either of those movies really caught a light. But again, like you said earlier, as with Beautiful Boy, it didn't do him any... it didn't discredit him. It didn't do him a disservice to do either of those films. So I that's why I think your analogy makes sense. Marty Supreme is the film that announces it. Leo tried a few things that were a little different before he announced it with Wolf of Wall Street. But there's some when we're talking about announcing things, there's something about the volume of that, the scale of it.
Yeah.
And I, you know, for better or worse, Marty Supreme is announcing something, isn't it? It's a very announcey film.
Well, why for worse? There is no worse here. No,
I said for better or worse.
Yeah, but why for... Well, there's no worse here. It's just for better.
Because I think there are, you know, there are some people who have been a little turned off by the way in which the film has announced itself.
Oh, okay. Well, I'd wanted this conversation to be like, we would go in and we would just like... It was as if we both left the cinema... And we were both, because when you left the cinema, you WhatsApped me, right? You WhatsApped me.
By the way, this is what you said before we started recording the podcast, but 22 minutes in, you're yet to ask me what I thought about the film.
Because you weren't looking forward to it.
You'll recall that when we talked about this last time, I said a friend of mine told me he'd never been more excited to see a film than Marty Supreme. And I was completely baffled by that notion. That is the main reason I went when I did, to try to understand what the young people were so excited about. So, and I didn't think I was going to like it. I thought this was a sort of film that would have all the trappings of little sort of cotton candy sugar lumps for children. So I went in fully expecting to be bored.
Yeah. So I said, "How was Marty?" And you went, "Oh shit! I wanted to hate it, Kate. I did want to, but it's really good. Too long, but really good." So you've said it's really good. Great. And then now I'm annoyed because I'm thinking, oh God, I'm going to watch this now. And Joe says it's really good. And now this completely ruins the bar to entry for me. Because now I'm going to
want to hate it. That was the one little saving grace of me enjoying the film, was that, okay, maybe I can spoil it for Adam now.
So I just blanked that out. I was like, oh, Joe doesn't actually know about movies anymore anyway.
Yeah.
So how did you, when you came out of the movie, tell me more. Just tell me more. I want this. I want the positive. That feeling when you WhatsApp me, it's really good, and you can spoil it now.
My wife has gone to the toilet. I am stood outside the cinema alone.
I thought you're announcing that now. It's like, why are you telling me what she's doing? What is she going out to flush a big shit? And is that going to ruin the sound?
No, I'm talking in the present tense, so to increase the drama of the affair.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Okay. Your wife's gone to the toilet.
And I'm stood outside the cinema alone. It's a cold, crisp evening, and I don't feel the chill because I'm hot off the trotting that's just happened. And I'm hot off, what is it, hot off the trotting that's just happened. The film ends with the song, what's it called? It's Welcome to the World, isn't it?
Everybody wants to know. Welcome to your life.
Is that Dire Straits? Is that
I walked past people, old people. It was wonderful, the cinema. You get onto yours, but the cinema was packed. And it was full of either quite old people like me or very, very young people. And I walked out of the cinema and everyone who was still sat in their seats were quite old, and they were singing along to that song like it'd come on the radio. That's in a real millennial boomer-esque way.
Well, it's I don't want to spoil the film, but the one thing I thought I'll come back to my present tense story in just a moment. One thing I will say, a nice little thing about the film, is that halfway through I had a critical thought. I thought, I'm enjoying the music that this film is using, but I do feel slightly manipulated by it, because what's all that's happened really, and this is halfway through the film, is I'm thinking, these are so far 10 of the best songs that were released in the 1980s, and time enough has passed that they're allowed to use them in art films and it be considered artistic license, as opposed to just like when the film 21 with Kevin Spacey used an MGMT song in the opening credits, right, when it was the biggest song in the world at the time. If this film was released 40 years ago, this isn't art. It's just because time has passed. However, when I get to the end of the film and they play that song, I go, cool, all is forgiven. It's because it perfectly blends with the story I'm being told. And so I think the reason that I'm light on my feet outside, my wife is in the toilet, she's probably having a great time in there too, the people in your screen are singing it, is not just because it's a fantastic song, but because it's a fantastic moment and it makes you want to sing. You know, the end of the film, it really is. It's a lovely, lovely ending to and perhaps lovely and slightly unexpected ending to a film. So I'm walking on air. That's the feeling that the film gave me. And the first thing I do is text you. And the second thing I do is open up my little movie diary and write down, I've just seen the second best film of the year.
What I really loved about the 80s music is, I mean, the film's set in 1955. So when you're Josh Safdie, you're thinking, how am I going to score this flick? It's a sports movie.
Ain't nothing but a hound dog crying all the time.
Or do you just go, he's got a great composer, he can just go, you score. And it's like, no, well, what is the apex? All the best sports movies are in the 80s.
Yeah.
And that's why the use of 80s music works so well in this, is because he wants to make a sports movie like a kind of a Rocky. Well, which is, maybe that's my late 70s, but yeah, basically Rocky 3, Rocky 2, Rocky 3, all of that, Karate Kid, it's 80s, and so those songs just fit so well, and it's just, also, it's just the dissonance between that, the 55 and the 80s of it, it's just perfect. It's such a, it's so well judged. It's just, you're watching someone who just knows how to make a movie. And you're in safe hands, and everything about it is just so entertaining. And Timmy C's bringing it. The commitment to him being an absolute arsehole is what I really liked. It creates this horrible character who all he wants to do is, he wants to win and dominate in ping pong at the cost of everything else, at the cost of his relationships. He's not a very nice guy. And it just never bottles it. It never softens him. It never weasels out. He fully commits to that, and it's just very satisfying as a result. I think, yeah, I really enjoyed it. I don't know if I'll. Yeah, I'm interested to see what I think about it in 5 years.
I'm never going to watch it again.
I'll watch it in 5 years when it's on telly,
right?
To see, you know, because you say it's your second. You think it's the second best film of the year.
That's what I think. Yeah.
Yeah, but you can't make that call unless you go forward 5 years and watch the other movie. The other movie is one battle after another. For, you know.
Yeah.
So unless you rewatch them in 5 years and can, in the cold light of day, and actually look at them and sit with them, you're just talking about taste.
I disagree. You can't, because that's what you need to do. I don't need to do that. I know from now.
But then you're just talking about taste and you're ossifying.
Yeah. That's all I can talk about, isn't it? I couldn't possibly have an objective opinion about these films. I can't take myself out of it. That's, you know.
But over time, when you revisit a film and you're like, no, yeah, that movie is fucking superb. It wasn't just I watched it and I felt great.
Sure, yeah.
That's what I really mean. And then it's like, what is the movie that really spans time?
Yeah, not this one. Two reasons I'm not going to watch this film again, okay? The first one is, It's too long.
It's always two.
And even though it, and even though it is an evolution on Uncut Gems, another film I'm never going to watch again. It's too much of a physical experience to watch the film. I am never going to. Like, I'm so glad I saw it in the cinema because no one should ever watch this in their home. Right, their home. Your home is for relaxing. The cinema is for watching a film that gives you a physical experience. This is where you need to see this movie. Okay. The second reason is because I want to remember how I felt watching this in the cinema, because this film, in 5 years' time, is a performance movie and isn't anything more than that. Whereas One Battle After Another will be a fantastic film, an ensemble, in 5 years' time. This film only gets worse over time. This film is a footnote in the huge career that will be Timothy Chalamet's career. And young film students will watch it when they're 21 years old and they'll go, wow, this is incredible. And then 10 years later, they won't, they'll just think it's very, very good. I guarantee you that's how I'm going to feel about it in 5 years' time. Whether the whole world does or not, I don't know. But like that's my perspective. And that is because it is a physical, emotional, exhilarating experience movie. It makes you feel something. And so it causes you to leave the cinema, as I did, walking on air, feeling like I've just had this experience I can't even really put into words. Something's happened to me. I don't know exactly what it is, but I know that something's happened. Whereas One Battle After Another is the gift that just keeps on giving. I went to go and see that film again 3 days after. I would never want to do that with Mighty Supreme. So I feel on solid grounding as to at least my subjective reasoning here. But I know you didn't really love One Battle After Another, did you? So I think I can imagine which of these two films you think is better at the moment.
Yeah, at the moment. And but as with Magnolia, it only matured as I did. So when I rewatch One Battle, whenever it is, it's still popping up in the cinema, but I can't. I'm going to have to rewatch. I will rewatch it, but it'll probably be a couple of years. And but the more people insist it upon me, I'm not interested. I'm not interested in the narrative around it. It does ruin it, you know. Everything, and that's, I would say, is partly my fault. But I would say it's also everyone else's fault. Like the insistence of something being good. Or, you know, I mean, even like your mate saying Timmy C is the goat, you kind of like, it just makes my skin crawl. Just to be so insistent about something so new, and like the idea of something being an instant classic or an amazing thing. Let's see. Let's fucking find out, all right?
You can't find out whether an instant classic is an instant classic. It can only be categorized as an instant classic in the moment. It can't be categorized as an instant classic 5 years later. It's just a classic then.
Yeah, oh, fair. You got me banged to rights there. But then there's no such thing. I reject the term. There's no such thing as an instant classic. It's a nonsense. But there are so many films that came out at the time that just were ignored, and then slowly find an audience and are revealed to be great. But it's lovely that people are excited about going to the cinema and talking about the cinema for both of these movies, One Battle and this. And it's like,
my screening was full as well as yours, you know. I think, and also I think the trick with movies like this is you gotta go opening weekend before all of the guff that you're describing gets to you, because I mean enough of the marketing around this film had already put me in at a place where I thought I wasn't going to enjoy the movie.
But yeah, I mean, Timothée Chalamet on this, Mighty Supreme, promoting it, before I went to see it, I just thought, the man's lost it. He looks like an absolute fucking bellend. And this is where he moves into... And now I've seen it, I'm going to check. But back last week, but when I was thinking this, I was thinking, oh, he's ceased to be an actor now. He's going to be a star, and I'm going to not be able to enjoy his performances. But having seen the movie, I think it's funny, and I don't care what he did to promote it, because he's playing a buffoon.
Here's what he said. He said, "I'm leaving it all on the field. whether it's the merch or the Zoom call or the media appearances, I'm trying to get this out in the biggest way possible in the spirit of Marty Mauser, who is the character. So what you're saying is like is absolutely right. He's promoting the film as the character, which personally I think is just kind of a little sort of sideways door to enable oneself to do this. But because there are a lot of stunts involved in the marketing, and I imagine it's been incredibly successful. The guy who I told you, my young friend who called him the GOAT and said he was excited about this film, that guy's seen four films. It's a running joke in our friend group that he hasn't seen any films. And he was excited to see this before it was released in the cinema. That tells you about the impact of a marketing campaign like this.
No, and I'm usually a massive Grinch about stuff like this. And I think it's funny, but I think it's more interesting than just going on Graham Norton and releasing a trailer. It's something that Andy Kaufman might do. And he's having a laugh. And you can both think he's a bell end and or not. And then also, I think most people who go to the cinema will not be aware of any of it. You know, there's a portion of people who are invested. I've looked back at a lot of A24's marketing for their other films for a side project, and I had barely heard of any of them. You know, they're kind of PR-y stunts that happen at the time, and then if you're already invested, you're aware of thing. The Zoom call would have passed me by. It didn't, because someone I work with brought it to my attention. So, and I'm the audience. So there's also like, who is actually going to see any of these things that Timothée Chalamet has done? Kids, which is interesting, which is exactly who, you know, I want to get to the cinema. Not because I'm a pedo, because they're the future of the cinema.
Yeah, yeah. And because you're a pedo.
Not just because.
Anyway, here's the thing he did that will ensnare your future children. Victims into the cinema. Okay, he did these things. He filmed himself. Well, he didn't film himself. Someone filmed him standing on top of the Las Vegas Sphere, which is that massive sphere. Have you seen that in Las Vegas? Yeah. There was the bright orange branded blimp, a large orange Marty Supreme blimp was flown over parts of the US, creating viral social buzz. Writes Colin, I should say.
Hey, hang on, can I ask you a question?
Yeah.
What does Tom Hanks think about when he goes to sleep and falls to sleep? What does he do?
What does he do?
He dreams big. What does Tom Hanks do when he's just come back from Marty Supreme? And he's thinking about an old movie he used to be.
What does he do?
He dreams big, Joe.
I've got one for you.
Yeah.
What does Tom Hanks do after? No, hold on, wait.
I'm already laughing because I know this is going to be the best fucking joke in the world.
What does Tom Hanks do after he's been to
I'm going to hold on because I can't wait.
Please wait.
I'll wait all day for this.
I can't believe I forgot this fucking name. What does Tom Hanks do after he's got home and fallen asleep after... What does Tom Hanks do after he's got home and fallen asleep after attending a bar mitzvah?
I don't know.
He dreams Big Lebowski.
Oh, because I thought you would go somewhere else. I was going to say, what does Tom Hanks do when he goes to the airport?
He dreams of Terminal. Yeah. That's good. Yeah. I like that one. What does Tom Hanks do he falls asleep at Matt Damon's house?
I don't know really. I'm a natural glutton for lots of things. A glutton for punishment, I suppose, being one of them. It's amazing. amazing to me that I've been doing this job for over 20 years now.
Do you want to hear what Peter Bradshaw thought of the film?
Yeah. I don't know how I came. Yeah, sure. Tell me what Peter Bradshaw, Mr. Know Nothing Opinion, Mr. Jumps on the Bandwagon. I'm going to say what everyone else thinks. Bradshaw. Yeah, please tell me what Peter Bradshaw says.
Can I ask you a question, though? If I hadn't already told you that he'd given it 5 stars, does a bit of you think he might have given it 2 stars or something, or 3? You know, like, would you have known that he gave this 5?
I would have thought maybe 4, because he's not the guy who says, oh, everyone else loves this film. There's nothing you could rag on this film about. There's no way that he could hang his hate to give it 2 stars. Anyone who gives this film 2 stars is a charlatan and is just doing it because they want to go against the grain. And Bradshaw, although he is a charlatan, he needs some backup to be a charlatan.
He's grainy for sure. He's got to stay grain most of the time.
He's pure grain. Yeah.
Well, here's what he said. He talked about the film. He said the film, pure craziness is a marvel. He said the film's comic and absurdist effect resides in the slowly dawning realization that it's not actually about table tennis. Marty Supreme doesn't behave like a sports movie. There are no training montage sequences, no scenes in which Marty explains his technique in voiceover, no scenes in which he either listens humbly to some ping-pong mentor or Oedipally rejects him. Oedipally, but Brad has always got to include something like Oedipal in there, hasn't he? And unlike Forrest Gump, who becomes a patriotic celebrity through his table tennis gift, Marty is always a reprehensible character whom no one really trusts. Which is true. You've got to give it to Bradders there. It is true. I would say that's it's a fair synopsis of the movie.
He has not said anything there. He's just described things in the movie.
Well, he said the pure craziness is a marvel. That's why I led with that.
Okay, that's how many words is that?
Six words
of an opinion, and then the subsequent fucking sentences is just drivel observation.
No. I mean, I know you hate Bradders.
No, but it doesn't. Go on. Yeah, I do hate him because
there are one or two.
He says one or two
things in there. Let's not argue about Bradders. Here, let's argue about Henry Wong from Esquire. And the reason I've included Henry Wong from Esquire is because there were very few reviews that gave any kind of sort of negativity to the film. I had to look quite hard to find them. And the only ones other than Esquire and Henry Wong that I could find were even less notable publications or indeed not real publications. So that's why I've included. This is no shade on Henry Wong or Esquire, by the way. I'm just sort of setting the stakes here. I had to look to find someone who didn't like it. Here's what Henry Wong said. Like its lead character, the film is a notable failure. Henry Wong writes, "The arrival of Marty Supreme resembles less the opening of a new film, so much as the launch of a new religion. Evangelistic whispers form preview screenings about Josh Safdie's new tale. Breathless reviews from on high, sought after and boasted about merchandise. Not so much a tagline as an entire ideology. Dream big. And the face of this second coming is Hollywood's saviour and patron saint of the internet. It's Timothy Chalamet." Here's Henry Wong's main criticism of the film. "In the second half," writes Wong, "it loses focus and descends into a sometimes intriguing, sometimes tiring mix of Promethean ambition and muddled romance, caught between its director's predilections and awardsy ambition." So, to be fair to Henry Wong, I do think the second half of the film suffers a little bit and is a little slower and a little more, a little less focused. It's evident, like, the reason I included that first section is because Henry Wong opens his review with a description of the marketing campaign. And I think it's pretty evident that this is a person who's been turned off by the film potentially before they've seen it. Or at the very least, you know, like the first paragraph of a review of a film is dedicated to talking about the way in which the film has been marketed. It suggests that the response is about a little bit more than the content itself. But I do think, like, Like I said to you when I came out of the cinema, walking on air, but the film is too long. And for me, it didn't fly by in the way that One Battle After Another did. There were periods of the second half where I thought, I won't go into detail because I don't want to spoil the plot line for people, but I really do think that there's 40 minutes you can just lift out of the film.
I disagree. It flew by for me. Everything earns its pace. That guy, that guy's review, it's not a review. He's angry and annoyed at Timothy Chalamet and the marketing. You just have to ignore it. People, critics are cunts, right? Fundamentally, they are writing for a word count and to get paid. Anything they say about a movie is completely irrelevant because they've got an axe to grind or they're being paid for an opinion. No fucking reviewer ever for a movie of this kind of scale is either going to, they're never going to go, yeah, this movie was fine, because no one's going to read it. They've always got to have an angle. So it's either this is amazing, it's the second coming, which was all One Battle After Another reviews, or you're going to do the Esquire angle and you're going to go, this is Emperor's New Clothes. It's rubbish, or there's nothing here. There's loads here. It might not stand the test of time. You could be right in that, but it's wonderfully made. It's wonderfully acted. It's funny. There's a wonderful inevitability to everything in there. There's setup for, you're watching it, and that people say something. There's so much wonderful. There's so much lovely foreshadowing, and then when it pays off, it's hilarious. You know, I had a great time. I laughed really loudly.
I laughed really loudly too. I do. That's probably something we haven't made enough of yet, is that it is really funny. I went to see it with my wife, as mentioned, because she went to the toilet afterwards, and we did a lot of loud laughing together. And she's a normal person, so that's a good sign. One thing I will say, I didn't write any of these down because they weren't real people. They were just pretend people who were leaving reviews on Rotten Tomatoes, where it has a very high criticometer, by the way. But the one common thread I could find in the reviews of ordinary people who didn't really enjoy the film that much was that they didn't like the character and they found it hard to enjoy the film whilst really disliking the character that Timothy Chalamet was playing. And I think that's obviously a subjective response, but I think that's fair, right? Like if for whatever reason you didn't like this character, and maybe that's something that you're bringing to it as a viewer, or maybe it's, I don't know, just a particular predilection you have, it might be quite difficult to enjoy the film because the film really is just a vehicle for his performance. It's a very, very good vehicle, but he's in virtually every single scene. He's the whole spectacle. The emotional arc of the movie goes up and down based on what he does. It's, you know, if you don't like Marty Supreme, you're not going to like Marty Supreme, I would say.
I think it's more honest than One Battle After Another because everyone likes Leonardo DiCaprio in that film and he's very, very funny. But the way that the film stacks the deck to like him and make him likable is a nonsense. It's a dramatic nonsense because he's horrible. He's a bad dad. He's a fucking cunt. But it's like, but the way he is pitched, it's like it's lovable because the film wants him to be lovable, and I think, you know, it bottles it. Whereas Mighty Supreme, Josh Safdie has got some backbone, and it's like no. The whole point of this character is he is deeply unlikable. Whereas
I wish listeners could see your face in this moment because you've got that look. You've got the cat who found the cream. Like you've been looking around the room for the last hour, and suddenly think blindly, you found a big bowl of cream.
I've been spearing myself in shit and I've finally gone, oh, hang on,
I've struck gold here, this is it, this is the one, it feels right as I'm saying it. You've got this big old sweet grin on your face.
I know you want to talk about Oscars.
I do.
And I think this is a lovely segue into Oscars because obviously Leonardo DiCaprio is going to win Best Actor. Obviously Leo is going to win Best Actor and obviously...
Well...
PTA is going to win. Obviously, he's going to win Best Director.
I wouldn't
he
be
is.
So sure. Best Director, I think PTA is going to win Best Director, but in the Best Actor category is not how you portray it, Adam.
Timmy C's not winning. I'll tell you that for nothing.
Timmy C is currently the favourite.
No way.
Yep.
He's not beating Leo.
The betting odds have him currently, the aggregate betting odds currently have him as a slight favourite.
How often, you're into the stats, okay, how often, retrospectively, obviously retrospectively, not the future, do the bettors like get it right? Because how could the oddsman and the fucking Betfairs and all those horrible little betty cunts have any insight into what like 1,000 Oscar people are gonna, the whims of what they'll vote on?
I mean, I can't answer that. The question is based on a myriad different factors that are
well
beyond,
done for not saying by, myriad of. Well done.
Yes, thank
Imagine
you.
Imagine if you'd said myriad of.
No, you would have torn me apart. I know that for sure. I've just asked Colin if Colin is able to answer or come towards answering your question. So historically, Oscar betting favourites in the acting categories, especially Best Actor, win most of the time. Betting markets have accurately backed the favourite in the Best Actor category nearly every year over the past couple of decades, with only very rare exceptions where second choice beat the favourite. What I will say is that I imagine that Colin is basing the betting favourite on who is the favourite on the day of the Oscars. We are still, you know, 2 months away, right? So, like, it will change over the course of the campaign. And it's possible that the reason that Timothée Chalamet is the favourite today is because the movie has come out this weekend, because there's huge buzz around it, because it's been a while since we've heard from Leo, because, you know, different movies are at different stages of their marketing campaign. All I will say is that the odds are as they are means that the race is very fluid. I will say that Timothée Chalamet hasn't swept the season, neither has Leo. So usually one of the indicators for whether someone is going to win an Oscar or not is how many of the same equivalent award they pick up, or category they pick up at other awards ceremonies in the lead up to the Oscars during the awards season. And in a year when it's a kind of odd, you know, like Jesse Buckley, for example, is winning every single category, every single acting category, every single award ceremony for Hamnet, because she's going to win the Oscar. Like, she's nailed on, everyone says it. I guess it could change, but there's a good indicator for you. Whereas in the case of Leo, the case of Marty Supreme with Timmy, neither of them have done that. And actually, a month or two ago, everyone was talking about Ethan Hawke for Blue Moon.
Has Leo won an Oscar?
Yes, he won an Oscar for, was it not for The Revenant? He won it relatively recently.
That's 2015.
2016, yeah, he won it for The Revenant.
That's 10 years ago.
It was 9 years ago, yeah. I mean, well, it will be 10 in two days.
What? Yeah. Come on, 10 years ago. It'll be 10 years ago.
Yeah, that's relatively recent.
It's not. Timmy C's not ready for his Best Actor, and this is not it. He's great in it, but Leo is winning.
I hope so. What for do you two think? Reasons.
What do you think? Aside from the bets,
you know, I love to give two reasons.
Go on, two reasons. Tell me who you think's going to win, and tell me why.
I don't know who I think is going to win.
Well, of course you
do. I really don't. I really don't.
Pick one.
I think Timothée Chalamet is going to win.
Oh, okay.
I wish he wouldn't. I wish he wouldn't, because I
you
because
wish
I
wouldn't.
For two reasons.
Right.
I want Leonardo DiCaprio to win.
Mm.
Because I love Leonardo DiCaprio, the actor. I don't know anything about him as a person. I haven't read his biography yet. I feel the need to say that. But I also love the film, One Battle After Another. As much as I admire The Cat Who Got the Cream, I just completely disagree with your point. I think Leonardo DiCaprio, one of the reasons I love him in this film is because he plays a pathetic loser who is lovable in the film, but is also very unlovable. And I don't think there's dishonesty in there in the way that you at least said that you thought. I don't know if I believe you, but that's what you said anyway. I think he deserves to win it. I think it's the best film of the year. I think it's the one that in 5 to 10 years time will be the one that's remembered. And also the second reason, it's not because I don't like Timothée Chalamet, but if we want to extend this sports athlete analogy, then this guy cannot win the Best Acting Oscar at this stage, right? If it's his hunger and his desire, if, as he says, that's causing him to create the kind of performance that he did for Marty Supreme, then I want to keep that fire alive. I don't want to pour a big wet fucking ice bucket Oscar acting award on that sweet, sweet fire. Let's keep it blazing. Let's throw some fucking oil in, yeah?
That's why Leo's going to win, because a lot of people in Hollywood will be looking at Timothée Chalamet, and they'll find the way he's promoted this movie, they will find it very distasteful.
Maybe.
And they'll think, this is brazen. And I think they'll be turned off by it. And unfortunately, they'll miss the great performance. And I think he's going to miss out, because there's a certain, like, you know, famously when Sally Field won an Oscar, and her performance, her acceptance speech was, "You love me, you really love me." And that was a big joke in Hollywood for a long time, you know, after that. Field couldn't get out from under that. And Timothée Chalamet has already done it before he's even won. You know, he's splayed himself out there, and they are going to thumb their nose at him, and they are unequivocally going to give it to Leo.
I hope so.
Ethan Hawke's not winning it.
Well, the one thing I think is interesting about the Ethan Hawke inclusion here, and I don't think he is winning it. He's 10-1 or something at this point, so I think he's not really in the running at this stage. However, I like to think about, when it comes to the Oscars voting, if they're voting for Ethan Hawke, who are they not voting for, right? And I don't know that Ethan Hawke is going to pull enough as like a second left-wing progressive party to pull away from the main left-wing centrist party, to use an analogy. I don't know, yeah. is Ethan Hawke going to be the Liberal Democrats here and form a coalition with, I hasten to say, who the Conservative candidate is? I don't know.
Hawke is pulling Timmy C voters. You know,
I don't know. I think he's pulling Leo voters. I think he's pulling traditional voters.
No way.
Oh man, it's a movie about Hollywood. It's a movie about show business. It's a movie for people who loved the way that traditional charismatic acting works, who are much more comfortable with voting for Leonardo DiCaprio in a big motion picture from that year. I don't think he's pulling votes from Timothée Chalamet.
Okay.
I think he's pulling votes from Leo.
Okay, no, that's quite interesting. I thought...
Caveat, I don't know how the voting system works. It's possible that they get to vote for a first and then a second. I really don't know. I should find out.
Yeah, me neither.
Shall I ask Colin?
But I think it's more interesting to talk about it as if it is like this, you know?
Ah, okay. So each actor branch member, this is how the voting works. They nominate candidates in the acting categories, and then that's for the nomination stage. They rank them in nomination stage, and then it is a single transferable voting system. So I guess that means that if people voted for Ethan Hawke first, but they had Leo second, then maybe if it's not Ethan, I still don't know. But it's more complicated than I thought, I think, we think, I don't know.
A long time ago, I was in Burma. My friends and I were working for the local government. They were trying to buy the loyalty of tribal leaders by bribing them with precious stones. But their caravans were being raided in a forest north of Rangoon by a bandit. So we went looking for the stones. But in 6 months, we never met anyone who traded with him. One day, I saw a child playing with a ruby the size of a tangerine. The bandit had been throwing it away.
So why steal it?
Well, because he thought it was good sport, because some men aren't looking for anything logical, like money. They can't be bought, bullied, reasoned, or negotiated with. Some men just want to watch the world burn.
Hey, do you want to play the box office game?
Yeah, let's play it. Let's play it. It's tricky.
Caveat, we can only really guess budget, because...
Let's not play the box office game then.
Do you want to play the budget game?
Let's play the budget game.
Okay, how much do you think, brackets estimated, that Marty Supreme cost to make?
Well, Timmy C's hopped on board as producer. They've got the star. They know, they've put it through the computer and they've gone, beep, boop, beep, boop, beep, boop, boop. What is a movie with Timmy C headlining, produced by A24? What does that make?
What does it make?
I don't know, but they then go, so this is what we can spend on it.
Yeah, what does it spend?
A24 is spending a lot more money these days. 40 million?
65 million.
Oh!
I think it's one of their more expensive. I guess the only one I can think of that would definitely be more expensive is Civil War, right? Which was a little bit more than that, I think.
They're making Elden Ring, aren't they?
Oh, is it A24 that's making Elden Ring?
It is, yeah, absolutely. Wow.
be curious what they do with that.
Alex Garland.
Oh, yeah, of course. Alex Garland.
I'm only curious because Garland's doing it, and I'm a Garland guy.
I wonder if it'll be as hard to watch as it is to play. You know, that'd be fun, wouldn't it? If the point was you had to, like, what if you had to re-watch the same scene 28 times until it ended successfully so you could move on to the next bit of the game? Do you think that would be fun?
Yeah, I mean...
I don't think that would be fun.
No, but I've not played the game or... but yeah, maybe that's what Garland would do.
We should play... I've just invented a game in my head. We should play the A24 game, which is pick some unsuspecting IP... and then pick a director and a lead actor and say, this is a new A24 movie. So, for example, I would say that there's going to be a live-action remake of The Animals of Farthing Wood, and Josh O'Connor is going to play the lead fox, and it's going to be directed by, I don't know any... Who's the person who made that Jeez. French movie with Vicky Krieps, you know, the one that you really liked? The one where the guy falls out of the window and is it a murder? We all learn about the French court system.
Vicky Krieps isn't in that. It's a different... It's Sandra Hüller.
Oh, Sandra Hüller, sorry.
Anatomy of a Fall.
That's the one I meant.
Yeah, yeah.
Who directed that?
Yeah, that director.
That guy, that director, yeah.
Don't know.
That's it. What's your A24 movie?
Yeah, it's amazing how you had the premise... I watched this happen in real time. Joe had the premise for the game. Any lesser man would have gone, he's had the idea, I'm now going to throw over because I haven't got an answer. Joe, he's had the premise for the game and he's instantly, he's near instantly got his own answer. He's got The Animals of Farthing Wood instantly. He's got the fucking actor, Josh O'Connor, bang on. At the thought.
And then I got confused
doesn't matter. He's got the name of the director wrong. It doesn't matter. He knew who he meant and the director of Anatomy of a Fall. That is an A24 package. And that happened in the blink of an eye, I want to say.
You don't need a supercomputer. Just hire me, you know. I'll do it again. I'm doing the biopic. What's the snooker guy's name? Rory. What's his name? Fucking snooker. You know the snooker guy?
He's called, Ronnie O'Sullivan.
Ronnie O'Sullivan. Okay. It is the biopic of Ronnie O'Sullivan, which, by the way, nothing has ever been more A24 than the biopic of Ronnie O'Sullivan. He is played by, who's the guy from, you know, he just won for The Brutalist. What's his name?
Adrian Brody.
Adrian Brody is playing...
Anton Brody.
Adrian Brody is playing Ronnie O'Sullivan, and it's directed by who? You know, it's directed by... Oh, I'll tell you who it's directed by. It's directed by... what's the name of the documentary maker who made Amy and Senna?
Asif Kapadia.
It's made by Asif Kapadia.
It's not, actually. You know, you're actually smashing it. I'd say it's directed by the director of Honey Boy.
Okay, sure, yeah.
Or Andrea Arnold,
yeah.
Yeah, the cheat of the game is you just go, or Andrea Arnold. I mean, Joe's already just done two amazing ones and I can't...
No, go on, you've got one.
Have I got one? Am I allowed one?
I think you've got one.
They've got Dog Tanyan. They're doing... A24's doing Dog Tanyan.
What's Dog Tanyan? Is that D'Artagnan but with dogs?
Yeah, don't you remember? Oh, is this art before your time?
Maybe it is.
Dog Tanyan. So I think it was originally French, but they dubbed it. It was on in my childhood. Dog Tanyan.
Right. That sounds
great. It was D'Artagnan, but it was with dogs.
Yeah.
And I don't know why I'm pitching this because I fucking hate
to be honest,
swashbuckling.
I think the Four Musketeers, A24 could do a good Four Musketeers reboot.
No, they could, but no, they're not. They're doing Dog Tanyan.
They're doing Dog Tanyan, yeah.
It's called Dog Tanyan.
Yeah. It's going to be rough out there, isn't it? It's going to be real rough out there.
Oh. No, I know who it's directed by. Yeah.
It's
directed
gonna be
by...
poor takings. Go on, yeah.
It's going to be directed by the guy who directed The Green Knight.
Oh, that guy. I love that guy. What is his name?
David O'Leary. David O'Leary.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Not David O'Leary.
David O'Leary.
David O'Leary. David O'Leary. They're going to get him in from... David O'Leary is going to come over and direct Dog Tanyan.
Get David O'Leary in.
And the beautiful thing is, with Dogtanyan, it's actors with snouts, and you just pop the snout on,
right.
And you can have any age,
anyone,
but you Ray go Winston. Sexy.
Oh.
No, Ray Winston's obviously one of the baddies.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
The sexy baddie, Kat. There's the woman baddie. What's called? Madame something.
Madame Bosoms.
Florence
I think
Pugh.
She's called. Yeah.
Madame Bosoms. She's played Florence Pugh.
Right. Yeah. Obviously.
Oh, she'd be a wonderful sexy cat baddie. Come on. And then you know you just do Mescal, Dickinson. You just do the Beatles.
Paul Dickinson. Dickinson.
Harris Dickinson. Paul Mescal.
I'll tell you what.
Harris Dickinson.
Can I say a serious point?
Fucking the one, Colin O'Farrell, and the other one. They're all, and you just dress them as dogs.
Right. Can I just make a serious... I really like that, by the way. Can I make a serious point? I just watched Priscilla, you know, a couple
really?
Of nights ago. Yeah, yeah, yeah.
It was on the telly. Well, I saw it was on the telly, but is it any good?
Put this into perspective, how little I like this film. I left the film with 10 minutes left to watch. My wife continued watching it. I don't care at all. Main reason I didn't like it, Jacob Elordi. If we're talking about a young generation of new actors, you just mentioned, you know, you've got the Mescals, you've got the fucking Harris, David Dickinson. David Dickinson's. And then I just saw in the trailer for Wuthering Heights movie where he stars opposite Barbie. I'm actually kind of interested to see that film.
Barbie. You know, everyone's been talking about Barbie.
Everyone's talking about Barbie. He stars opposite Barbie in that movie. And I just think, maybe I just haven't seen him in the right roles yet. But I'm not getting the Jacob Elordi charm. I don't know. I'm not sure if it's grabbed you, but it hasn't grabbed me yet. And I'm sort of pissed off about it because I'm like, come on, you're playing Elvis.
Yeah, no, he stinks. I saw him in Guillermo del Toro's Frankenstein and it's embarrassing. He was embarrassingly shit. He sucks. I quite liked him in that Saltburn movie. But yeah, he's nothing. He's a big, pretty boy, buff, sexy twat. He's got nothing.
He's a big sexy twat.
Ooh, lordy. Get the fuck out.